But I think some of you know that we, Harold and I, were in the Peace Corps in Liberia for 3 years, and then we were transferred to, or as we were leaving, we joined the Lutheran mission through the LCA. And we're in the same country, but not in the same location. And then during the time we were in the mission, we moved again. So I'm just going to point out on this map where we were, just to give you an idea. And each one was a different tribal area. We started up here in Nimba County, and which is quite a distance from the capital city. And then we came to Phoebe, to Bong County, and we're there 1 year. And then we later transferred up to Lopa County to a kind of a real bush hospital up there. So it was three different tribal areas that we lived in. And while it was quite some time ago, because we came back in 1977, went there in 1971, it's our feeling that life for the majority of the people who live in the villages is not any different from what it was when we were there. And as Muriel says, it's probably even worse now that they've had all this war that's gone on for nearly a year. While we were in the Peace Corps, I was did public health work with maternal child clinics, did vaccinations and health teaching and things like that. I also taught the school girls to sew. And during that time, this wasn't a Peace Corps assignment, but I worked for the Methodist Church in the hospital at Ganta, and taught nursing students. So then we were there 3 years. Then we went on to join the mission, and we were at Phoebe Hospital, which is where both the Petersons were. We were there 1 year, and again, I did community health outreach. We did vaccinations, health teaching, maternal child nursing, and after we were there 1 year, we were asked to go to a hospital that was farther up in the country, which is where, go back. Anyway, there again, I did community health outreach, published a little newspaper once a month for health workers, and ran the medical supply department, and also helped organize the Christian Health Association of Liberia. And during that time, I also taught in the School of Nursing and Midwifery in that particular place.
I went over as a mechanic instructor and discovered after we got there that it was almost an impossibility to do much instructing. We had some old tractors there. We tore one completely apart and put it back together again just so that the fellows that were my students could get an idea of what the workings were. We couldn't get parts. And so it almost reminded me of the old Model T Ford days when you tear it down and could use a piece of baling wire and get it back together again. We did have that tractor running though. And that was about the first 2 years. And my third year in the Peace Corps, the government there, we were responsible for the library government. And they had me as a project engineer, so I got a chance to do other things like getting some more land cleared for the farmers for their planting their swamp rice. And just being with the farmers and helping them whenever I could with any little mechanical problems, because they didn't know one end of a wrench from another, and they just couldn't fix anything. If it went to pieces, it sat there. It spoiled. They couldn't use it anymore. So I fixed up quite a few threshers for them, rice threshers and things like that. And then when we went into the mission, I was engineer at the first hospital for a year. And then there was a changeover in hospitals. The man that was at the upper hospital at Loaf County, he wanted to come down to Phoebe, so we did some changing, swapping, and I went up there to go to him. And that was just mainly maintaining the hospital. It's just about like the maintenance men here, maintaining the hospital, and there was various things that I had to do for, well, it run into everything. It was electrical, plumbing, you name it. We had to do it. We had no choice, because there wasn't one person wasn't responsible for just one item. You were responsible for all of them. And that was really the main thing that I had to do over there.
Okay, I'm Dick Peterson, and I was up a week ago, and I did a little bit of one presentation on library, and I believe Muriel did one this week. But
Okay, keep talking.
Well, I was going to point something.
I'm just going to write down Phoebe so people know what's spelled like.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to show some in the scene where these places are here. Just to draw back just a little bit, if this is Africa, this is Liberia here, just in case you had to look it up on the map like we did when we first went there. And then if this is the enlarged Liberia, the place where you read in the newspaper about all the problems now is Monrovia. You go up country to about this point, that's where Phoebe Hospital, where the Lutheran Church has a hospital compound there. This is up Zaza, that's where you were, that's another Lutheran hospital. This Ganta is about up here, the Methodists have a hospital there. Up a town up here called Senequale, that's where the Catholics have a big hospital and educational complex. And then down in Monrovia, all the churches have their kind of headquarters and a compound and, you know, things like that. So that's some of the main areas that in Liberia where the churches have centers for their activities. And I was the chaplain for Phoebe Hospital, a hospital that had about 150 beds and served about 400 people in an outpatient department each day. And so that was called over there and served under the Lutheran Church in Liberia as a chaplain for the hospital, and also had a parish that ran down this road about 20 miles, just with preaching points in a lot of different villages along the way there.
I was called to be the first woman Lutheran pastor in Liberia. Big title. I was called to be the pastor of the Lutheran Church that was headquartered at Phoebe, but I also had one of my preaching points was at the Leprosy Center, and I built a new church in Swakopo, and we had other preaching points besides the place at Phoebe. It was a large parish. Then I was I taught at Bonga School of Theology, which was just 10 miles away. I taught basically preaching and things like that there. And then I also was head of a school, K through 12 school, 375 students, that was at Phoebe. So that was the types of things. We were there from 1987 to 1990. We came back in April, second half of April, and we left the same day as the Peace Corps people were left because of the, they left because of the war. We left because our term was up and also because of the war. So we have been there quite recently, but certainly not as long. We represent a church perspective. They represent a Peace Corps perspective, but not
plus church.
Uh-huh? Not really just
plus church.
Plus church, but yeah. I mean, but that's why I didn't finish. Peace Corps plus the church. So that gives us. We just decided.
I have to apologize. I checked the board today, and I was sure it said 8:30, and so I've been wasting time until 8:30, and so here I am to moderate this. And
so we introduced ourselves.
Hey, great. the forum format is such that we're not out to make any conclusions or anything this evening. We're just out to have you ask questions and have them answer questions. And about 9:15 or so, I will just put an end to discussion, and then we'll have a few closing remarks.
I would like to just give some idea of what it's like to live in a village, and something about what how the people live, and also talk a little bit about the culture and some of the cultural things that I see as real barriers to development as Westerners view development, and give you an idea of what it was like for us to live there. And probably would say that if Peace Corps volunteers go back, at least now when the war is over, that their life would probably be very similar to ours, because they would most likely live in the small towns and in villages rather than in a mission establishment, you know, something like Holden, but not quite so large or so fine. We lived in a village the 3 years that we were there, and worked. For a while we were the only white people. Then, for a good part of the time, there was a Peace Corps. Well, for a little while there was another Peace Corps couple, and then there was a young Peace Corps volunteer. So we were pretty isolated. We were 12 miles from the nearest town and had no transportation, so the way we would get there would be to go sit on the roadside. When I taught at Ganta every week, I would go and sit beside the road waiting for a taxi to come by. And a taxi was a pickup truck that had seats and probably a goat and a bag of rice and filled with people. And it would cost me like 25 cents to ride, but I would have to just go out there and like maybe an hour ahead of time and go and wait to get there to teach my class all afternoon, and then do the same thing on the reverse. Our house was very modest. When I'm describing what other people would live like. We would have to have our water carried and have it boil, or else we would have a rain barrel. And the water, we'd have a drain, you know, a kind of a little trough on our roof, and it would run into our rain barrel, and then we would have to have it boiled and filtered. And we had a houseboy. And if you don't have a houseboy, and I imagine you people were the same, or a housegirl, you didn't have a houseboy. We could not have done our work if we did not have a school child to take care of our marketing and our cooking and our washing on the washboard. Because it would take you all day to do those, just to take care of your living. And then if you did not have a houseboy or a housegirl, generally a boy, because a girl didn't really get to go to school after she got to be about 14. She was probably pregnant. And, you were very mean, because that's the only way kids could go to school, because you would pay them for your work, and then they could get the money for their school fees and their uniforms. And I'd say that going to school nowadays is going to be very tough for kids, just as it was in the past. We ate rice every day, and that is a staple food. If the people don't eat rice daily, they just say, "I didn't eat today." What we were was at a rice project where the government was trying to get the people to raise paddy rice so they could get three crops a year, as opposed to country rice, which they would have once a year. And if they couldn't grow rice and save it, they would just probably not eat.
We're just commenting. Some of us that were at Phoebe this last time, we were trying to respond to and talk about the house help. It's a little different at Phoebe because we were equipped with refrigerators and stoves, and although number of people did have house help with them, we didn't feel that was necessary. Mm-hmm. Because, and we did our own cooking and things. But what we did there, there was a tendency of the children sometimes to go from one missionary to the next to see what they could gather from each. And so we organized ourselves and we established a scholarship fund for all those children. And we then, as a group, we had the principal of the school collect applications from the children who were interested in having help. And then he would bring them down, and this, a committee of three or four missionaries plus the principal would decide which children. And we had about 20 or 30 children that
every
we were able
semester,
to send to school. Yeah.
30.
So it was just, it was a different way to do it, and because our circumstances were a little different, we didn't have the need for the
hospital. We had a group of people that would.
We gave our own scholarships too, but we didn't have them work.
Yeah, each of us contributed
money. But that's not really.
But actually, what we want to do is maybe ask more questions, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think you people have some questions, though.
Yeah, please feel free.
I don't know anything.
If you want to hear something about.
I want to know about the conflict going on now.
Well, I can just maybe start kind of where we were last week.
Yeah.
Like, we left in April. In December this past year, this fellow Charles Taylor entered the country through this area right up in here, up in Upper Nimba, or this area of county. He came in from Ivory Coast. And Ivory Coast has had a little bit of a conflict with President Doe ever since he took over the country and killed the son-in-law. Killed Tolbert's son, who was married to the daughter of this ruler over here, and it didn't go over very good. So he let them come in there somehow. They never admitted they let him in, but they let him in. And they started coming down through the country and worked their way down this way, and they just somewhere, when the government, those soldiers heard that they were coming in, the government soldiers came in and just raped. Strenuously brutalized the whole area. They went through and pilfered villages and shot people, just gunned them down. And so it actually encouraged the people to support the rebel movement. Well, then they came into the country, they'd come down a little ways with a series of victories, and they'd stop and train in new volunteers and retrain them, give them weapons and stuff, and they'd move on down the country. When they got down to within about 20 miles of Phoebe, that was just about the day in which we left. The Peace Corps people were pulled out by the United States government out of Phoebe at that time because they were fearing for the safety of the Peace Corps people. And then what's happened since then, you've probably been reading in the papers in between the other news articles. It's usually back on page 4, 5, or 6, or 10 or whatever. But basically they've taken up the whole country. They worked their way down toward Monrovia, and then they for a couple, 3 months, they were just kind of bogged down right in Monrovia. They're shooting back and forth. Somewhere along the line, one guy named Prince Johnson, who had been previously an ally with Taylor, they had an argument and split. And Johnson's troops seemed to be more on this side, and Taylor came in, took over the airport out here, and came in this way. And they just fought around there for a while, and finally, you've read in the papers a couple weeks ago that they finally, after the peacekeeping force came in, it was the countries around here, except for Ivory Coast. Ivory Coast wouldn't send any peacekeeping forces in because they didn't want to take any chances on having Doe be able to stay in power. So, was it Nigeria and Sierra Leone and Ghana? Yeah, they sent in 3,000 or 4,000 troops. Came into basically, I think, in this area, and they. They kind of set up a safety, or you know, a station there. And apparently, Doe went out to see them or something one day, as we can best you can determine from news. And Prince Johnson's troops caught him, and they claim he tried to get away. They shot him in the legs, and then within the next day or two, there was some torture going on to his body, and he was shot. And the newspaper said they carried him around in a wheelbarrow around town. People in Monrovia took turns stabbing him with knives. And it was really a brutal. Anyway,
but that's the way he had treated the people in 1980 and in 1985, so it's, you know, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth type of thing.
So could you talk a little, we came in a few minutes late, could you talk a little bit about the makeup of the country, the size, north to south, east to west, the tribal factions, what's the population?
What are the underlying things that lead into the conflict?
The population is 2.3 million as of the last December. It's the Liberia is a little bit smaller than the state of Virginia, just to give you some idea. It is made, there's about 200,000 to 300,000 in Monrovia. That's always unknown exact number because there's all the shanty town around there that was quite unnamed. I don't know the exact distances north south. Do you know? But anyway, you can get the basic idea.
It's about 175. Is about 175 miles from Monrovia
That would be this strip here is about 175, so this looks like it's about 250-300 miles.
Can't mention those major industries.
Okay, there's rubber plantations all over, and Firestone has a big rubber plantation right about in here.
And they've been there for many, many years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Up here was a Swedish, at Ukepa was a Swedish mining center, iron mill. Iron place. They just about a year ago, they gave up as a Swedish group, and they turned it over to an inter-Liberian group, which has never got off the ground. Over right in this, right in this area was another mining area.
German.
What other industries?
Most of the rest of it's kind of just
basically farming.
Subsistence farming.
Yeah. Right. Very subsistent.
Can you think of any other industries?
Major tribes?
There are about
17.
16, 17, 14.
Yeah. It used to be 28, and I think now...
Now it's 17.
Is it 17?
17 tribal groups.
So some are so small, and some are very large.
Right. That's one of the things maybe we talked about the other night. Doe's group was a Kron tribe, Resident Doe. Kron tribe came from out in this area, someplace in here.
Yeah, down right there.
Yeah, right down here, down about this low part. This area here where they came in was Mono and Gio tribe. I think Taylor is Mono. Now, in 1985, there was an attempted coup when the elections were very, very corrupt. 1985, in fact, some Americans, historians have said it was the most corrupt election ever conducted in the name of democracy. When that happened, there were people who were the Gio and Mono tribe group who voted against Doe, and they never forget. Mm-hmm. And so the Monos and Gios have been basically punished all this time, second-rate citizens. So when they came in, it was the Mono Gio people through whom they came down through their country, and of course they rallied around, and the Krons are very angry at the Mono Gios. So, in some ways it's tribal, but in many ways it's not tribal. I mean, it's a political thing. There's injustice in the land. There's lack of human rights in the land. And that's a lot of it. But they come along these lines.
I could say one thing about the original government was the Miracle Liberians. That was the slaves that were sent back from the U.S. President Monroe's time, and that's why Monrovia has the name, the capital city has the name Monrovia. And they run the government then up until 1980. And I'll have to say one thing for that government, it was, as most of the governments over in Africa are corrupt, but they at least were trying. They had the Israelis up there clearing oh, I don't know how many thousand acres altogether of for paddy rice. And two of the men that I had in Peace Corps that I had been working with and training went up there, and they were, the one ended up, after the Israelis left, the one ended up being the project engineer, and the other one was running a backhoe, and he made all the canals and all that, and he did his own mechanic work on it. But I feel that that government at least is trying. And at 1980, in the area where we were, I had the same Israeli people clearing probably another 100 acres or so for the rice paddies up there. That was a good area. And as soon as Doe got in power, that all just went like that. It all grew up into brush again. People just left.
They stopped any support, and so there was never any repairs for their rice machines or anything.
No fertilizer
or
anything.
I want to say something about the Americo-Liberians too. There were only 3% of the population was Americo-Liberians at the time we were there. And they had everything, the education and the power. And they also had all the money. I mean, there was so much money that was skimmed off and kept by the president and all of his people, whether you were a county official or whether you were up in the government. And so there was nothing left to do the very basic things. For instance, getting vaccinations, be able to do the inoculations that we had to do, that all came in from UN and other places that came through the government, but they didn't pay for any of that. And plus, the government for, oh heavens, how many years back, has been a one-party system. One president was president for 28 years. Mm-hmm. And the people liked him because he would give them small things, you know, small money. But he just had millions stashed away in Swedish banks. And then when he died and the new president, Tolbert, came in, he was president for how many years? 12, 14 years, something like that. And then, of course, then there was a coup and he was killed. But there's been, they call it a democracy, but it has not been a democratic country.
Their constitution is very democratic.
Mm-hmm. It's very much like
ours.
But
it's not, it has not been able to be put to
base. But what I was getting at, though, is that Doe, when he got in there, ruined everything that the previous government had tried to do. The people were a little better off under the other system than they are now. Now they don't have anything. Now they're just back to zero again.
But the dreams were that it was going to be better under Doe.
Yes.
That was the dreams, mm-hmm. because now Doe represented the common person.
Common man.
That was the common people back in the village. He was one of them. He'd had only an eighth grade education.
Army sergeant,
yeah, and, you know,
educated in a mission school.
Yeah. And, you know, he was the grassroots man, mm-hmm. so they thought this was going to be the answer to their questions. And now they're, you know, but you know what happens with power.
Corrupts. One of the things you have.
I'm just curious, listening to this, I must confess woeful ignorance. Doe, I don't know how that's spelled.
D-O-E.
Johnson, what were the other names you mentioned? They were
Taylor.
Taylor.
Is it fashionable for them to take
yes.
anglicized names
yes.
or something? Is
yeah,
that
yeah.
where this has come from?
What happened was that when kids would go to school, they would have their country name,
mm-hmm.
tribal name, but when they'd go to school, they were supposed to have a school name. So you would have kids that would always have
lots of Moses and Joshua's and things
yeah.
like that, because they went to the mission school, so they
yeah.
picked up, and
uh-huh.
then there were some that got.
But they also then would have their own tribal name.
But there was many while we were there now that they were not
going
doing
back
as much
to,
of that.
Right.
So one of our dear friends was Jima Fula Latia. Okay, it took me a long time to be able to say that one. Now it seems so easy, but oh boy, that took me a long one.
Yeah, that has been a kind of a nationalizing feature. Like there was a when we were in Greeley, Colorado, there was a man there from Liberia. I just barely got to know him before he went back, but his name was Joshua Giddings, and he was doing his master's PhD in music. Now, when he went back to Liberia, he took the name of Damalo Gading. That was more in,
well, that was,
that was his tribal name. And there's been a more of a tendency to take on their tribal identity and not use their, this Robert Rainey, Robert Brown, who worked at the hospital, mm-hmm. All of a sudden he was Robert Rainey, and that was his, mm-hmm. that was his tribal name. Mm-hmm. So they're going back to more of that identity.
Well, and Robert was only his American name, but he also had the other. So names are changing
these,
back.
Were these basically names given by the mission schools so
yes.
that they could say them?
Or the teacher will say
so that the teacher could say the
pronounce
name.
Them right.
Yeah. Or if they were a house boy or a house girl for someone, they would sometimes take that person's name.
Mm-hmm. So right. here, yeah. Jacob, our son there, wanted to be Jacobson. And we said, no, you're so difficulties as far as, I think as far as Americans and as far as Christians are concerned, when they are working with people there, not only are they having this awful trouble with the war and no money and, you know, the awful government, but when you're working with the people, you are also up against some of their cultural practices and their cultural beliefs. I imagine you people met up with that as well. But I, especially I saw it when I was working with mothers, because I did a lot of work with maternal child. And just as an example, and you're trying to explain that that really isn't the way it is, that this is, you know, when you like to talk about cause and effect and all these scientific things, they don't hear that. If a person has twins, this was in the counties where we lived, and I saw it especially in Lofa, that people were just afraid of twins. The first time I discovered twins, when I was examining a lady, she and told her she was going to have twins. I thought that was exciting. She started to cry. It was just really a tragedy. Number one, it's hard enough to feed one baby, let alone two babies. And then the other thing was, they are afraid of twins. Because they are, they believe, and I'm saying generally now, they believe that the babies, they will just kind of gang up on the mother or the father and do something bad to them. So deliberately, they will withhold food from one of the babies. And I never could find out which was which, you know, how they would decide. But one baby, they would come into our clinic. And one baby would just be thin and small, and the other would be fat. And we'd say, oh, what happened? And they say, oh, he can't eat. So trying to talk, and I heard our native doctor also explain to them, it isn't, you know, that you have to feed this baby and so on. They would not do it, and eventually they would come back, there's one baby. And twins always have special names. So you know when you get a baby in the clinic that there should be another one, because that's only a twin name. And when you say, where is the so-and-so, they say, oh, he went back, or he died. And it's deliberate, because they do not want to take the chance that those babies will hurt them. Another one is that they believe that if they have sex, intercourse, while they're nursing a baby, that will spoil their milk. So here you'll have a woman, now I don't think they could even afford it, but they would start to buy milk, Nido. You know, that's why Nestle's was so terrible. They would be encouraging people to bottle feed their babies. So the woman would go off, would stop nursing her baby. They couldn't have enough money to buy milk, and so they would keep having watered down milk. The baby would get thinner and thinner. Mm-hmm. And eventually die, but they always would have an excuse for why they had to put the baby on the bottle. But it was because they believed that if they had intercourse with their husband or a man or whatever, probably the man they were with, then the baby, their milk would not be good anymore. Another, I'll just give you one more idea about. Trying to combat things like that, and this is when a baby dies or a child dies. It could be a twin or just a plain baby, and they are so afraid that the spirit of that dead baby will come back. I don't know whether you talk to people like that, but I saw this in Ghana. I even saw it demonstrated. the spirit of the baby will come back if they don't take, they don't do something special. So they will carve a little doll, just a little crude doll about this big. And they will do the same thing for that doll every day for till the baby is 2 or 3 years old. They will give it a bath. They will carry it in their, they wrap this lapa around them to carry their baby. They will carry that baby doll in their lapa. They will even feed, try to feed that baby. I saw this in a village. I walked into a yard and here was an old ma sitting and feeding a little child. And standing on the mat was a little doll with a piece of rice in its little mouth. And I had read about this, but I'd never seen it. But they just believe if they do not do that, the spirit of that dead baby will come back and steal their baby, and the baby will die.
Some one of you spoke about the secret cult in the tribes. Was it you, Ruth?
I was asking Dick about that, about whether the Poro, whether that, you know, the society business is still so strong, and where it was during this conflict.
I really don't know where it was during the conflict. I mean, it's a very strong factor in the villages.
There was two things that I can speak on that, of what I do know. In the secret societies, there are secret societies for men and for women, for boys and girls. And that's, it's almost, we were in the Christian aspect when we wanted to explain baptism. We could often use this plural society because they would get a new identity, they get new name, they would get, so there was some of that parallelism we could use to help them explain. But we do know that they get their tribal markings. And in this war conflict now, the tribal markings have been very, very significant. That and language. Because even when we were there, when you go through the border, you had to show your tribal markings. The men would have to take their shirts off so that they could see what tribe they were from. Now, the problem got to be the Gheels never had any tribal markings, and Gheels were an enemy. That was bad because the new Christian boys and girls were not going as much into tribal plural life, and so they were not getting these markings. Now they are the ones who be targeted because they don't have the tribal markings, and so there was a real panic for that. And also, just before we left, we were having a lot of troubles with Hartman. And Hartman were, they were expecting the elections of 1991. And the leaders of Doe's regime wanted to be reelected. And so they felt that they had to have medicine. So they would go to the medicine man and they would say, "I want to win the election, what do I do?" And the medicine man says, "Give me $3,000-$4,000 and I will arrange it." Then the medicine man would hire somebody to be a heart man who would go out and find a male. Usually a male would, from probably, what, age 10 to 25, 30, something like that.
Black.
Not white. Usually male. And they would take the heart, the brain, the guts, the eyes, whatever.
Finger and ear or something.
Finger,
like
ear, whatever.
And genitals.
Genitals. And they would carry these to the medicine man, and the medicine man would make a potion and give that to this leader as a promise that he would be able to be reelected. I think they have learned a lesson.
I doubt it. But, they were doing it right around TV Hospital.
And they were doing it right around us. They were dying around us. Our kids were scared. And a lot of them were scared because they wanted to pick upon the young men who had not been to Poro school. And many of ours had not been there, and so we had to protect them. And our home, in fact, Hartman was picked up a young person just probably, 200 yards from our house?
there have been ritual murders in Liberia for so long, but it has really gotten worse, I think, and at least maybe because I've heard about it in the newspapers in the last 10 years.
Could be too. It's only been in the last 10 years that they've been in a position to run for a political office. And so they didn't have any reason to use them before, but now that they're actually in the election process, they have this, they got to use this medicine. Yeah.
Of course, there were other reasons why they would do that.
Yeah,
I think
it's part of the political side.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I brought that up because I think that directly has to do with the war, too. I mean, because that's part of this whole election business that was anticipating.
Well, the other thing I'd like to say is that I just feel strongly that the churches have a real calling to respond when this whole conflict is over. I know the Liberian people that remain will not give up. They just have a lot of hope, and they just are really strong. And I've been told by I think Jerry Currens from the mission office said that the American government is prepared to come forth with aid once it's possible for them to go back there. But now, of course, there's not anything that's being done.
I did talk to Karen Tompkin. Her name is different now. Mm-hmm. Rob. Anyway, she said that it was in the newspaper. One thing was in the newspaper, I think it was a couple of days ago, that the Marines aboard those ships had helicoptered in a couple of tons of food in just to certain critical areas. And then Karen said that a ship had recently docked there and was had a full ship full of food. And the person who is in charge now of the distribution, not coming, it's not just being distributed right at the Lutheran Center, but it's being distributed by this Dorothy Diggs, who is Bishop Ronald Diggs' sister. Mm-hmm. And she's done some work with, I don't know, the UNICEF or something before. So she's the project coordinator for distributing this food now. So apparently they're getting to do some of that. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that if there's some kind of outbreaks of violence, they can. There's $27,000 worth of medical supplies are being put together. The ELCA borrowed money from another fund. They're hoping to get volunteer donations to pay this back, but they put together $27,000 worth of medical supplies for Phoebe Hospital. Mm-hmm. And they're sending it over by MAP, what do you call that? Mm-hmm. And then the Lutheran World Federation, or the Lutheran World Relief, I can't remember which one it is has sent over $40,000 worth of stuff. And then they're holding another $40,000 so that as soon as they can get it into the country, that'll be distributed too.
Well, I know that the World Health Organization was sending in a team as soon as they could do it. Mm. And one of the Lutheran missionaries, Deanna Isaacson,
she's there,
was going to be a part of that team. They were going to go in through Buchanan, which is down on the coast, and try to assess the health health situation.
She is still there.
And she is there now. Uh-huh. But it's not safe for people in a lot of ways to even be traveling about. Number one. Number two, fuel, I think, and automobiles and so on are probably very critical. But I think that the churches, this is a situation where the churches could certainly help once there is some direction that what they could do. And I would hope that all of you people, would be able to keep track of what you could do and really get your congregations to assist.
In fact, Dick brought up, we just got in the mail, Dick brought up, and I can, if it's all right, we'll get ask permission, maybe we can get a copy of this made. It tells what's happened and where we can, and the sources of where if you want to send money or help. The ELCA, MAP, so I can leave that if you want to have an address. That's okay. But I think you people have
some
questions.
Yeah, we can sure deal with the questions.
Who's in control right now of the country, and what do you see is
who's in control?
If
you read the newspaper tonight, it's chaos, bedlam, and no one's in control. And what we feared would happen is the West African peacekeeping forces came in there to bring peace, and they're there, but they don't know what to do. There's just total bedlam.
There's really not enough communication and coordination between the countries there. And then once they get in Liberia, there's no communication system. So so the soldiers kind of just milling around and they don't know what to do, and nobody's powerful enough to say this is what they're going to do.
Those people have just taken revenge too, haven't they? They've said, well, the soldiers have just been going down and wantonly killing.
And raping and pillaging.
What's going to happen? I wish I knew. I thought at one time that probably Taylor's troops would have the best chance. And Taylor is determined to keep. He does not want the West African peacekeeping people in there, and he has good reason. Nigeria is taking a very strong leadership. Nigeria does not, or was very pro-Doe. Okay. Johnson was doing some negotiating with Doe, with the West African people, and had some pro-Doe agreements. And I think Taylor is very fearful about what that can mean. In fact, in one communication, it said that one of the soldiers under the Nigeria said that their purpose was to get rid of Taylor. And I believe it. Nigeria has also said they're going to replace the president that has been put in by the West African groups and put in their own Nigerian. So I'm not sure what that means. I'm not sure.
And neither Taylor nor Johnson are even qualified in any way to lead a government. So how they could even form a government. I think Dick or one of you mentioned that there are a lot of Liberians, expatriates, who are in this country, and some of them, it has not been safe for them to go home for a long time. And there are people that have been here, they have very good educations, and would be wanting to go back to Liberia and to take part in whatever way they can. But
Taylor is a very educated man, very highly American educated.
But I haven't read anything that, as far as his character or anything, I mean,
that's part of the problem with all the Liberians in this country. They're waiting to go back. We really don't know what their motivation for going back
right.
is either. So
right.
they may make things just more educated mm-hmm. mess.
Yeah.
No.
Scott?
Well, I was going to ask, wasn't Taylor a part of Doe's government at one,
yes.
one point? And so apparently there was some attempts early on to include other tribes or something. And then did that all fall apart at some point? Or how did he ever get to be a part of the Doe government as someone from another tribe?
I'm not sure if I know.
I don't know. I don't know how that was. I do know that there were a few token people from different tribal groups. He had to do that to appease the people.
And that may be one reason that he got in there. The other thing that's kind of scary about that is that his whole group has been kind of underwritten by Libya. And that's, I asked at the mission office two or three months ago, because I've been talking with him probably every other week on the phone, and Jerry Currens, who's head of missions there, said that his money and arms and all that stuff had come. Had you heard that? Had come from Libya.
Those were the first statements,
but
there's some question now. Just because of the arms that he came in with really were not that
sophisticated.
Good that they would have thought that, you know, if Libya was really backing it with any energy at all, they would have sent in more sophisticated weaponry. Oh. And it was just basic, you know, the little clip guns and stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. a few cannons and stuff, but nothing really that would give him a substantial...
May I quote from the African News that might answer that? U.S. officials had their own view of their intentions. They at one time said that he had come in, it was a rebellion, a Libyan-supported effort to overthrow Doe. The answer by some other people has been, overthrow Doe, yes, but Libyan-sponsored, no. The rebellion is just a coalition of grassroots citizens. If the group had Libyan backing, why did it invade the country armed with only a few hand weapons? A fact testified to by the refugees' eyewitnesses' accounts, and we know that too. I think that if Libya had actually been behind it, it would have had much more sophisticated equipment and a lot more people. Now that's just, you know.
It's what you're reading yet.
Yes.
Somewhere you get lots of different opinions. You hope that what you're reading.
I don't know. We ever felt that it was Libyan backed. I didn't. It never felt when we were there in the country that it was that kind of thing.
Statement and then a question. As I've read about this whole situation, it's almost seemed to me that Liberia is almost becoming the Lebanon of Africa. Just a thought. And then secondly, I hear you talk about three major tribes. How do the religious beliefs, you know, one of those tribes or two of those tribes tend to be more Islamic than the other? Where does the animistic African belief come in? Or is one of those tribes more Christian? Do you have an Islamic Christian conflict here?
There is 10% of the country is Christian. 20% is Muslim. 70% is animistic or African traditional. The Mandingos, which are not just limited to Liberia, but that is a Muslim group, they were siding on the side of Dole, and they joined the Kron grouping.
They're being killed.
But as far as the other three tribal groups, they would be there was the church that was in all those areas. I had some neat Mono and Gil people in my own congregation. I think there were some Krons. I mean, you know, and in fact, it goes still, you know, clear across. In fact, when the people invaded Liberia, they came in first and hit one of our newest church's missions over there, our Lutheran mission. That was the first city they came in through, and they wiped it clear out. And I've got pictures of us in that village with those people. We had just built a new clinic there. It was burned down. They took all the people had decided they were going to make sure that all the people of their village could eat, and all the rice was burned.
This was Taylor's group?
Taylor's and the Liberian ones. I mean, you never
know
knew
who actually does
who was doing what, you know? I mean, they didn't have uniforms.
At the time when they first came in, they'd come in and strike across the border, and then they'd go back. And then the army would come in. The internal news is really hard to, but you kind of got the impression that they'd come in and strike, maybe at the border guards and stations and things, and then when they heard the army was coming, they'd run back over the Ivory Coast, and the army would come in and just destroy everything and shoot everybody, because they didn't know who was siding with the rebels, so they just thought, well, if we shoot everybody, we're safer that way.
We do know that most of the destruction and most of the killing was done by the Liberian soldiers, not the rebels.
Somebody, how could relief get to these people, one that so many warring factions, and I don't understand how it would get through
Part of the way that's getting through now, I think, is that there are 400,000 refugees in the country surrounding Liberia, so they don't have to actually go into Liberia to help them. They can, you know, if they can get it through those other countries, they can get some help to the refugees. Mm-hmm. And then apparently they have some points along the borders of those friendly countries international agencies can come in, and they've established most of the international agencies now have always been sending their aid and their resources through independent groups in the country rather than through the government, because the accountability of the government has been so lax. So they send it like the Phoebe Hospital, and they'll do a project around Phoebe Hospital, or the USAID will do a project at their own research station or something, so that the funds and the things don't go through the government. They just have to find some way to get the government to let them come in. I mean, they usually have to pay small money to get them into the country, but But now they, if they can send food, like or medical supplies directly to the hospitals that are still functioning, they can become distribution centers for the food. But you'd have to have a certain amount of stability in the country before they could do that even. But
one of the things I would think about the needs when you realize that so much of the education is has been supplied by people who are no longer there, like the mission people, the Peace Corps people, the probably schools are going to or have been destroyed. There, the whole educational opportunities for kids is just going to have to start from scratch again in a lot of these places. And there will have to be people available that can even help to set up.
The principal, for instance, of Phoebe Community Lutheran School had to run with his family into Guinea. We got a letter back. He's trying to survive. I mean, just live. I mean, you know, make it through. I hope he'll be able to go back, and he will be able to. But once more, when the rebels came through, they destroyed everything. The seminary, we had given all of our books to that. I guess it's completely destroyed.
The rebels or the government?
The government. The government has destroyed it. But the rebels, I'm sure, helped, you know, because some of them don't, you know. The school, I'm sure, has lost everything it had. The hospital, we just got a letter, came this week from Dr. Wenigali. And if I could just, Dr. Wenigali, August 25th it's dated, but you have to understand that that's just gotten here, so that's new. If I could just give you a couple of highlights of this letter, maybe you can get a sense of what he was experiencing. He's the head doctor at Phoebe Hospital. He's the medical director.
For Baldwin County, yeah.
And for the Baldwin County, the whole county.
It's a big, and it's big a large
man.
Area.
Okay, not big in size, but big in wealth. He just says, I write to tell you that we are well and that Phoebe Hospital School of Nursing has remained open and functional during this civil war, though with limited resources. Despite the fact that we have received no shipment of drugs and medical supplies since we came under the control of the National Patriotic Front Forces on May 26th, no patient has been turned away for lack of drugs. To stretch our limited supply of gas oil, we now run our power generators only at night, using lanterns during the day in the dark areas of the hospital. This also means cooking the patient's food on open fire in an outside kitchen. The Civil War has devastated the whole country. In almost every village in Baldwin County, all the rice kitchens are now empty and not even a chicken can be found. To make things worse, no real farming activities are going on at present. This means that hunger will be around for quite a few years. We are now seeing not only malnutritioned children, but adults as well. In addition to taking care of Phoebe Hospital with employees who have not been paid since April, we are now involved with trying to set up a temporary home on the St. Paul Seminary campus in Bowman, that was a Catholic seminary, for children whose mothers were killed in St. Peter's Lutheran Church massacre in Monrovia. So the children have been brought up there. These children were brought from the St. Joseph Catholic Hospital when it was evacuated on August 11th, and almost 120 patients brought from there to Phoebe. So now Phoebe has become sort of the main hospital. Okay, so that's the latest word that we could get in written form. And he has given us a way for, he says, now you can mail, try to send things to me in the Ivory Coast and we'll have somebody run it across and get letters down. So we've now just got hold of how to get hold of him.
There's no mail in or out anymore.
The post office.
Yeah, and there's been no mail delivery for months.
And there's really no means of commerce either, because although technically the American dollar was the rate of currency, they really haven't been using it in the country for a long time. They've had what they call the dough dollar, which is
his own.
Yeah, and it was at the time we were there, you know, the black market was about 2 or 3 to 1 for U.S. funds. A month after we left, it was up to 9 to 1, and I'm sure now it's zero. Once dough is gone, dollars are worthless. Well, then, so So if you have some, what kind of money do you take to buy something with, and what does somebody give you in change? I mean, just, there's the only kind of, and there's nothing to buy anyway, so it's just, I don't know, just diesel oil and things they have, it just must be coming in from Ivory Coast or something, and they're using some offshore funds. Phoebe Hospital has always had a New York bank account, and so they, if they, you know, if they're still functioning, they can probably write a check. And to, you know, if some company's willing to bring in a truckload of diesel oil, they can write them a check in U.S. funds and then go back out of the country real quick. And so he's gotten paid for his diesel, so.
But that's only, you know, that's only about $50,000 in U.S. money.
That's for a whole year.
And that's supposed to take care of a whole year of all the medical supplies and everything that Phoebe Hospital needs. So if they're having to use it for...
They usually get $2 million or so dollars from the government if things go right, but they don't get that now, so they have to...
Janet, do you have a question?
Well, I'm just listening to all this and wondering, number one, has there ever been any basis for the nationhood of this place other than some line drawn on the map by a colonial power? I mean, is there any...
It was never a colonial power. It was always just...
How were the borders decided, though?
Well, they shifted a lot.
The tribal groups overpins a different group.
Is there any overriding national unity? Or are these just a group of tribal groups that have been put together in a so-called nation state?
Good question, but they've
It's a nation.
It's a nation.
Yeah, it's not a colonial nation. And that's different.
Yeah, and Ethiopia were never colonized. They always were independent countries.